Hi there, and welcome back to the Who Goes There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is David Agronoff of the PK Dickheads podcast, and we are going to be discussing Waystation by Clifford Simak, which won the 1964 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, David, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Excellent. I'm also a fan of your podcast. After you reached out to me, I've started listening to it. So why don't you tell my guests about yourself and about your podcast?
Yeah, so I'm also an author. I write science fiction and horror. I have 7 or 8 novels. I'm not quite sure exactly in print at the moment. I just recently released a science fiction novel called Goddamn Killing Machines from Clash Books. Think of it as if Philip K. Dick wrote The Dirty Dozen, right? The Lee Marvin movie. Yeah, I kind of had this idea that I wanted to write a book. I wanted to imagine, like, if Philip K. Dick was hired by Canon Films to write a Chuck Norris movie in the 80s, and then it was just so weird and over budget that it never happened. And yeah, that's my current novel, Goddamn Killing Machines, out from Clash Books. And but yeah, so our podcast is called Dickheads, and our co-host Anthony Trevino, he came up with this idea of, well, first he was going to read all the Philip K. Dick books in order just on his own. And after he'd gotten about 5 in, he started looking for a podcast devoted to Philip K. Dick, and he just posted, hey, yeah, it's really weird, there's no Philip K. Dick podcast called Dickheads. There really should be. And 2 years later, we're 26 episodes into the main podcast, but we also have a series of like 15 interviews with various Dick adjacent authors. And what we're doing is we are reading all of Philip K. Dick's novels once a month in publication order. So not necessarily the order he wrote them. Well, we definitely talk about the order in writing and the history behind the writing. And basically, we read it. So you can either use it as like a book club and read with us, or if you've already read all the Philip K. Dick, you can binge them. And we definitely have people like my friend Desmond Reddick, who does the Dread Media podcast. He likes all the PKD ideas, but he's not into PKD as an actual prose writer. So I know he's told us before that he uses us as cliff notes, like to get a feel for what PKD did, but not having to read them, which I can't understand, but hey, you know, and so there's 3 of us who host it, but we have guest hosts from time to time and we get into the nitty gritty of the writing, the construction of the books, the ideas, the themes, and Philip K. Dick as a person, which is, of course, always fascinating.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's real fun experiment. And we definitely, I think one of the things that people will like about it is we're 3 friends that love to, like, when we go to movies, we always come out and debate them forever. And just hear us getting into the movie of Prometheus, it gets brutal. And so I think the podcast has like a real fun attitude. I try to take things from a kind of scholarly like perspective, and you know, I think from beyond that, you know, I think it's just a lot of it's friends sitting around talking about one of their favorite authors. So I think it's pretty fun.
Right. And then you have a series of them, of course, on short stories that were turned into films. And those are fun. Those.
Yeah. Similar to your podcast.
Yes.
And we've done a lot of the same stories like Minority Report, Paycheck, and Total Recall. We're kind of taking a break from that, which is ironic, which is a great segue. Because we started to run out of short stories and that were turned into films, so we couldn't really do those monthly. And then after we did a April Fool's episode of Starship Troopers that we called Heinleiners, and you know, kind of just recorded it as if we were in an alternate universe where we were doing a Robert Heinlein podcast, which I'm really glad I don't live in that timeline personally. And we did Starship Troopers. And then shortly after that, we did Man in the High Castle. And then I just happened to read Stand on Zanzibar, the 1969 winner of the Hugos. And then all of a sudden I realized I had three of the 60s Hugo winners recorded. And so I was like, ah, I should just do all the 60s Hugo winners. And so that's kind of how I found your podcast, is because I was doing a micro version for Dickheads for our Dick Adjacent series. Mm-hmm. And we've only released those three so far, but we've recorded almost all of them. Okay. And they're going to be slowly coming out over the next couple months. And the idea for our Hugo series was to look at the science fiction over the 60s. And and that's kind of how we got started on doing that. And that's how I found your podcast, because I was searching for more information on Moon is a Harsh Mistress before we recorded our episode on it. Mm-hmm. And I searched podcast Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and I was like, oh, wow, this Seth Heasley guy, he's doing exactly what I'm doing on an even bigger scale of the whole all the Hugos. And I binged a bunch of your episodes, like some of my favorites, like Forever War and stuff like that. And because I've read a fair number of the Hugo winners at this point, especially considering this series.
Yeah.
So. And I did count, because I knew you were going to ask me how many.
All right, he read my mind.
Yeah. How many I've read? I've read 25 Hugo winners so far, with two more to go for this series for the rest of the year. I haven't read the Roger Zelazny ones yet, and that's last. But then it'll be 27, and if you count the retro Hugos, then I would add one with Fahrenheit 451. But
cool. I do count the retro Hugos, because they're on my list.
All right, so that's 26 so far, 28 by the end of the year.
All right. I'm up to 39 now, so I kind of feel like I'm on the downhill side of this.
Yeah, I know. You're getting there. And you've read a lot of some of the more recent ones. I have two. I read, like, Red Shirts and the Yiddish Policeman's Union and a few of the more recent ones. But I have never read a Harry Potter book. So...
I don't necessarily recommend just jumping in at Goblet of Fire, but you probably could.
So. Yeah, it is weird that, I don't know. I don't want to get into that, because that's a whole other political thing on whether that's science fiction or not. But But I've always wondered, because I know that it gets into the whole thing of whether fantasy books are valid for the Hugo, and I suppose that's fine. But, you know, that's a whole bigger issue, but... But my main focus, I love out-of-date science fiction, always have, my whole life. And so reading all the 60s sci-fi and some of the 50s ones. Now, I do like modern science fiction. Don't get me wrong. I'm a real big fan of Scalzi and Neil Asher, Cameron Hurley, Karen Lord, Nadia Okafor, some of the modern writers that I like. But... Brian Evanson, Cody Goodfellow, some of the people doing speculative fiction in the modern era that I really do like, but I do have an affinity for old school. I like the old style science fiction.
Cool. Well, let's transition into talking about some old school science fiction.
It doesn't get more older school than Clifford Samak.
Right. Exactly. So why don't you kind of tell me about why this book?
Okay, so I've been a Clifford Samak fan since the 90s, I think one of the coolest things about Clifford Samak is that to give an idea of like how old school Clifford Samak is, this is the guy who got a letter from a teenage Isaac Asimov, right? After he had written a story that Asimov had disagreed with something about how the story was written, and... Samak ended up writing Asimov a letter back that Asimov credits as one of the things that taught him how to write science fiction. So when we talk about Samak having this long lasting impact, this guy was writing science fiction in the 30s and wrote some of his best science fiction in the 50s and 60s. However, you know, he really goes back. And Samak is from Minnesota. And I have a personal affinity for Samak in that sense, being from Minnesota, as my family all has roots in Minnesota. Specifically, my father, who was born around the time when Cermak was writing. My father just recently passed. He was 83, but he was born in Minneapolis in the 30s. And that's when Clifford Cermak was a newspaper man working at the Minneapolis Star Tribune, right? Mm. And so most of his writing career, he was paying the bills by working as a newspaper man in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in Minneapolis. And he didn't really kind of break away from that and write full time until around the time that he won this Hugo. So I think his history as a writer is very rich and very deep. And, you know, for me personally, I discovered Cermak. I had a friend who actually is on my Way Station episode, or the Dickheads Way Station episode, is my friend Matt Whitaker, who is a bass player for a noise rock band from my hometown. And he he was the cool guy that worked at the record store that would give you suggestions for music, right? And but Matt was also a science fiction reader, and he first was the first person to tell me to read Clifford Cermak because he knew I was a sci-fi nerd. And I think at the time I was reading some John Brunner book, and he saw the books in my backpack and he said, "You ought to read Clifford Cermak." And the first one I read was his 1953 World Fantasy Award winning novel City. And I got to be honest with people, like, we're here to talk about Way Station, but if there's one Clifford Cermak book that I think everyone should read, it's City. City is a masterpiece of 50s science fiction. It was serialized over a couple different magazines. So a lot of people think of it as a short story collection, but if you read it, it's a very strong narrative. He had written it as a novel. He just chopped it up and serialized it, right?
Okay.
And City, if you've never read City, City is great. And it's basically, I think the elevator pitch would be, imagine a robot and a super intelligent sentient future version of a dog sit around a campfire and tell stories about the long gone human race, right? Mm. Neat concept, right? Even neater delivery. And but when you consider that it was written almost entirely in 1953, it is just mind-bending how forward-thinking City is. So, and I know people come to this podcast because they're looking for recommendations at some point. But I would definitely say if you're going to read one Clifford Cermak book, I don't think you should just read one. But if you're going to read one... I would read City, but there's many great Cermak books before and after Way Station as well. Ring Around the Sun is brilliant. Time and Again is the most Philip K. Dick-like. And I've been saving a few. I've been told that Choice of the Gods is incredible. That's one I've been saving because that's supposedly the one where he was like, I'm going to try to get all weird like these young whippersnappers in the 60s. And so I think kind of saving Choice of the Gods, because I want to read that at some point. But anyways, what we're here to talk about is not just Cermak in general, but it's the 1964 winner Way Station. So
yes.
And you just finished reading this. Was this your first Clifford Cermak book, Seth?
It was, yeah. And City is one of the ones that keeps showing up on, I get emails from Early Bird Books and other places about cheap ebooks, and City is on there a lot, so I'm going to definitely pick it up on your recommendation.
Yeah, dude, it's great. I think City is, I mean, it's definitely, you can tell it was written in the 50s, but mm-hmm. for those of us who like out-of-date science fiction, it's really pretty great. So, but this was a crazy year for the Hugos, the year that Way Station won. And I think, and we went into this very deep on Dickheads when we talked about Way Station, is, just the field in 1963, the 1964, of course, awards, is really incredible. I don't know if you looked at some of the other nominees.
I didn't, not for this one.
Okay, so are you ready for this? So Way Station was nominated with Glory Road by Robert A. Heinlein, which is always, you know, tough to go against Heinlein. I haven't read Glory Road, so I don't know much about that one. Witch World by Andre Norton, which Andre Norton was a powerhouse. Dune World, the original novella of Dune. So pretty.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. High caliber stuff. But most importantly, the one nomination that just bends my mind is Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, okay.
And so we talked a lot about Cat's Cradle in our episode because I don't get me wrong, spoiler alert, I loved Waystation. I really liked this book. Mm-hmm. But it's not better than Cat's Cradle. It is not better than Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important when we talk about, you know, the Hugo and the fact that it won the Hugo in 1964 is that I think that this is a bit of a lifetime achievement award for Clifford Smith.
Sure.
Because we know that Kurt Vonnegut was not like super happy to be called a science fiction writer.
Right.
And I think that the science fiction, the voters for the Hugo knew that Kurt Vonnegut wasn't going to show up.
Sure.
And so I think I honestly believe that this book won in part because of a lifetime achievement award. And one of the reasons why I thought it was so important to kind of go through some of the other things that Clifford Smack had done and who he was is because I think that you can't divorce his whole career when you're talking about why it won the Hugo in 1964.
Sure. No, I appreciate that background.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to listening to your episode.
So. Well, you're getting a preview here. But Waystation, it's not to say – I don't want to take away from the strength of Waystation. It's also placed 27th in the 1966 All-Time Science Fiction Novel Awards for Analog. And it also – in the 1987 Locus Books All-Time Poll, it came in – and a tie at 25th with another Hugo winner, Rendezvous with Rama, which I believe we've both read that one, right? So
yes,
that's a pretty strong book to be tied with. And in 1998, mm-hmm. when they did the all-time poll, it came in 31st. So people do love this book for good reason.
Well, maybe we should go ahead and start going into kind of non-spoilers on Waystation. I feel like non-spoiler is a little tricky just because without giving up the central conceit, you can't talk about anything in the book.
Yeah. But I think I can do it.
Okay. I feel like it's okay to give up the central conceit just because it's not really a spoiler so much.
Yeah. I don't think you can spoil this book.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of what makes Waystation a good book is the pastoral Midwestern feel of it. So,
yeah.
So Waystation is the story of Enoch Wallace, who was a Civil War veteran who was chosen by, he had a first contact during the Civil War with an alien who he calls Ulysses. And he's basically recruited by Ulysses to take care of and monitor this, station that's built inside his home. And it is basically like a giant transporter device that can bring aliens from all over the universe to Earth and basically duplicates you and brings you there. So Enoch, this Waystation, his home is outside of time. And it is when you're inside the house, you don't age. Time doesn't move. It's basically this like kind of bubble. It's a bubble universe, basically, is what the physicists would say.
Yeah.
And so when the travelers come through the gate, they basically are hosted by Enoch. So he has a chance to talk to travelers from all over the universe, from many different cultures and civilizations. And when the novel starts, there's some suspicion from the locals who are like, this guy should be like 150 years old.
Right.
Or 120 at that point, because it takes place in the early 60s. And, you know, why is this guy so old? Or why is he not aging? Yeah. And there's some suspicion. But basically, his home is this almost like a truck stop off the freeway of these interstellar travel lanes. And he becomes this kind of avatar for the human race over events that happen in the book. It is a really, so before we, obviously before we get into spoilers, I would just say, me personally, I don't think this is Smack's best, but it is a really neat old school science fiction book. It doesn't feel like a 60s book to me. It feels like 50s science fiction, which is fine.
Sure.
Because I like 50s sci-fi. You definitely know that this was written by a grandmaster of an older age of science fiction. This is not like the kind of drug fueled bananas stuff that you're getting from PKD or Norman Spinrad or even Le Guin, who was, you know, very forward thinking even in these days. It's definitely, you can tell it's an older generation writing it.
Yeah, definitely. Was this a first time read for you, or have you read it more than once?
This was a first time read for me. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And I'll probably definitely put it on the shelf and read it again someday, but,
yeah. Yeah. This was a first time read for me. I read about half of it on a flight, that I had recently. And it was a good read for an airplane just cause it's not what you would call action packed. It's definitely not boring.
Yeah.
You know, it does have that kind of 50s sensibility to it. And, you know, because there's, I feel like 40s and 50s science fiction, you know, kind of has that, nuclear threat is always somewhere in there, unless it's something that's, you know, off world. And this one definitely has some of that in here. But yeah, I found it just a delightful read. It's not very long. It's, I don't know, 220, 230, something like that in terms of the page count. But yeah, this is one that I'll definitely revisit. Without getting into spoilers yet, there's a kind of sadness about the book just because of the way he's kind of caught in between, where he's not fully a part of the human race and he's not fully a part of the Galactics. And so I found it a little somber in places.
It's definitely a melancholy, somber.
Yeah, melancholy. That's a good word.
Yeah. It's a character piece. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, it kind of sets up in the beginning with the government spying on him that you think that it might turn into some kind of, you know, spy story or whatever, but it's not that. It's but I do have a quote. This is Dickhead's listeners are gonna laugh because I always have quotes from PKD on the writing of it, but I have this cool quote from Smack, I gotta stay on brand, that I think sets up a lot of the tone that people can expect from this. Smack said, "I write about ordinary people, and most of the people who read my work are ordinary people. I'm disciplined to think that if there were to be an alien to come to Earth, he would seek out a professional. He would probably make an effort to talk to someone who is a typical representative of our race. I think that a breakthrough or something like a first meeting with aliens is more dramatic if it's made by an ordinary man, because if a specialist made it, he would not be as excited about it. He would probably go into a long detail of tests and wondering about it and trying to figure it out logically, while an ordinary person would react as you or I would. I think it's far more effective. I'm against hero types anyhow. They make the rest of us look so damn bad. A man who is always successful makes all the rest of us look terrible."
And right.
Now, he said that in 1980, but I think it's really telling of kind of what the tone was for Enoch Wallace as a character. But I think the primary thing for people, if they're trying to consider whether they want to pause it, read it, and come back to this, is, are you okay with the kind of pastoral, somber character tone and the 50s feel of it? And if you are, you're really going to enjoy it. But I think that's the main thing that, in a non-spoiler way, we need to kind of say to people.
Yeah. Well, I usually do try and come up with some kind of comps for the book, like people who, you know, like this other book or television show or movie. I really struggle to come up with things for this one.
Yeah, it's very unique.
Yeah.
And, you know, my first thing is like, well, you know, it's like Clifford Smack books. It's like, right. You know, it's kind of like that. But I would say it's kind of like I know this sounds kind of weird, but it's almost like sci-fi Steinbeck, in the sense of,
I like that.
I kind of got the feeling of like kind of Mice and Men, the kind of pastoral, like it's not, I'm not going to say it's as good as Of Mice and Men. I love Smack and I like this book a lot. I'm not saying it's on that level, but I think that kind of feeling and tone, like So imagine if Steinbeck was really into, like, you know, multiverses and, you know, physics bubbles and all that kind of stuff. And really, and honestly, like, Cimak was really ahead of the time. I mean, he was doing, I mean, Time is the Simplest Thing, for example, you know, written in the 50s, I believe, is one that's, if I'm thinking of the right book, has, like, mental travel throughout the, like, basically, like, remote projection through the universe. And Ring Around the Sun is basically about how the whole world changes when an unending battery is invented. And he wrote that in the, I believe, in the 60s. I haven't read Ring Around the Sun since I first discovered Cimak in the 90s, so I could be getting all this wrong. But you know, he was a forward-thinking guy, even though he is from the old school. I mean, he was my father. It was just died at 83, and Cimak could have been his grandparent, right?
Right.
So
wow.
When you think about how far back this guy goes, it's really amazing in that regard. And I don't know if this comes across in our podcast, but one of the missions for me anyways of my one third of the podcast is that I really believe in teaching the history of this genre. And I think, I think that the younger readers, and the reaction, I know recently there was a bunch of controversy over an essay that Norman Spinrad had written where he was decrying the difference between fantasy and science fiction. And a lot of the younger science fiction writers just, like, they had no context for who Norman Spinrad was. So they just saw him as this, like, get off my lawn, angry guy.
Right.
And
old man yells at cloud.
Right. And it just really makes me sad that some of these younger science fiction writers are not exploring the genre. And believe me, and I've heard a lot of these people say that it's because they're all old white men. There were more authors writing than just Heinlein and Asimov. And, you know, there were your Judy Merrills and your Sam Delaney's. Mm-hmm. And so trust me, young readers, you know, because I mean, Cimak's before my time, right?
Yeah.
You know, I didn't grow up. You know, and I think it's important for people to explore these works. And that's one of the reasons why I love your podcast. And
nice.
I hope people will, you know, listen to all of our stuff, like researching the old folks.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, kind of in terms of comps, I was thinking of First Contact stories. You know, if you enjoy First Contact stories, there's a little bit of that here.
Oh, yeah.
There were a few shades of The Day the Earth Stood Still, where you have, you know, kind of an alien who's sort of aloof from humanity. And in this case, actually, he's human. But you also have the aliens looking at humanity and going, yeah, you guys don't quite have your crap together yet.
Well, yeah. And I had avoided that comparison because we were still in non-spoilers. But
yeah, I guess that's true. That is a little spoilery. And
Day the Earth Stood Still is definitely a good comparison. Yeah. The original, not the weird Keanu thing. So
there is a bit of it in there, though. And maybe we'll get back to that if I can remember.
Yeah.
Maybe we ought to just go ahead and get into spoilers just so we can, you know.
I think if we hadn't convinced you to read this book yet, we're not going to.
So, yeah. Anything you want to talk about in spoilers, you know, if you want to talk about big ideas, themes, whatever, fire away.
So one of the interesting things, and this kind of ties into your other Take Me to Your Reader podcast, is that it was recently announced that Matt Reeves, the director of Cloverfield, and what else has he done?
Didn't he do the Apes movies recently?
Yes. And he recently did, or he's just starting a Batman movie. So the Batman.
Okay. Right.
but he just recently bought the rights to WayStation.
Okay.
And Netflix is apparently partnering with him on it. So we might get a Netflix movie of WayStation pretty soon. And in spoilers, I would say, thinking about how you would do WayStation as a movie, one of the things we talked about on our podcast was that if I was going to adapt WayStation as a film, I would set it in 1963, the time when it came out. But specifically, I would set it against the backdrop of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right. That's exactly what I thought.
Yeah, which Clifford Cimak didn't know anything about because he released it the same year as the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when you think about the fact that it came out around the time, that might add some weight to as to why this book is so highly regarded is because the world at that time was grasping with, we just almost blew ourselves up.
Yeah.
When with this showdown with Russia over Cuba, right around the time that this book came out, and the theme of you people just aren't ready for each for I guess another one would be Childhood's End.
Yes.
Arthur C. Clarke would be another comp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have that down in my list.
Yeah, but Childhood's End is there's a giant fleet of ships, and obviously right. I think Day of the Earth Stood Still with the, even though it's a little different because that one, obviously, they show up on the lawn of the White House and Klaatu, Barada, Nektu and all that. But Way Station is a more, is like a personal version of the Day the Earth Stood Still.
Exactly.
Because Enoch is given this ability to make the decision for humanity himself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And as a, because he is the one ambassador. And part of, it's funny because, well, I would lean into the fact that humanity is not ready because we almost blew ourselves up. A lot of it comes down to in the book is that one of the visitors is accidentally killed visiting Earth, and right. they do the burial wrong. Right. It, which is a really interesting thing, but he's getting into like the ideas of the customs, and here Enoch has to kind of grapple with, you know, I just don't understand the universe at large because I messed up. I didn't do the funeral rites correctly.
Right.
And it's kind of an interesting aspect of the book, but basically what you're getting into here with the story is Enoch over his 100 years, he becomes a citizen of the universe. And like yes. you said earlier, he's not quite part of the human race anymore because he understands the wider universe, but he's still a human being. And they don't accept him in the wider universe. He's not accepted at home. He's kind of in this in-between place.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really neat about Way Station is that you have the giant social political issue of nuclear weapons and is the human race mature enough to be a part of the wider universe? And then on a personal level, you have this personal version of the same struggle going on with Enoch. And
yeah,
it's just beautifully composed, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And he does it without having like big pew pew and, you know, laser guns and space opera, but does it with a Midwestern pastoral feeling. And it's really neat. So,
yeah. I didn't think it was so much that he did the burial wrong. It's just, the fact that he buried, you know, an alien in his patch, you know, in kind of a standard grave. And then he put some alien language on the headstone, which kind of called out to the people who were observing him, hey, there's an alien buried here. And that resulted in the alien being exhumed and desecrated. And that was what precipitated that little bit of conflict.
Right. And it should be noted that the aliens come from the same place as the aliens do in Contact, from around star of Vega.
Yes.
Which is hilarious to me as a 27-year-long vegan. Every time right. it says the vegans in there, I kept wanting to correct them and say it's vegans.
Right, exactly. I was reading it and I'm like, okay, now I know why he recommended this book.
No. My relationship with Smack goes far back beyond that, but I did find that amusing for me.
Yes.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the thing about Way Station, yeah, the burial thing, that's where the storyline with the spies and the people watching Enoch kind of comes back.
Right.
I kind of personally wish there was a little bit more of that. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I really found unrealistic or hard to swallow in this book, and, you know, I'll suspend disbelief in a lot of ways, but the government reaction was a little silly because
sure.
My memory of it is that I didn't buy the way that they were reacting to, like, oh, hey, there's an alien buried in your backyard, you know?
Right.
Okay. You know?
Yeah.
And so some of that was, you know, and again, on brand with dickheads, we don't suffer. If something doesn't make sense, or we don't grade on a curve because we like the authors. We point out the things that we don't like, and because for whatever brilliant things that there are, if there's something that's not so brilliant, I think it's okay to talk about it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And so one thing I wanted to at least pull on the string a little bit is talking about, you know, potentially adapting this or, like you said, kind of bringing it a little forward in time, right? And the further forward you bring it, the more you really have to suspend your disbelief about the level of surveillance that would be going on. Because if you bring it into, you know, the 80s or 90s, then obviously you've got satellite surveillance, and it seems like there'd be no way to keep a lid on it. Where it's set in the book, you're like, okay, I can kind of buy that there are people with binoculars and cameras with telephoto lenses taking pictures and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of in a backwoods enough area that there's just sort of rumors about this guy who should be older than he is. But the further forward you come, it would be difficult to keep that under wraps.
Yeah, I would just probably throw my head at the TV if I turned on the Matt Reeves version of Waystation and it was set anywhere beyond 1963. It really has to be a period piece. And I think it would take away so much from the story if you tried to set it in a different time. I mean, you could, but I think that also, this is one that, and listen, I'm not beholden to novels. If we want to adapt things on our episode about PK, because we always talk about how we would adapt. One of the parts of our show at the very end, we adapt in our minds the whatever book we've just read, and we talk about the way we would do that every single time. So that's kind of like, so in the Matt Reeves version had not been announced when we recorded our episode of Waystation. So okay.
Bonus content here.
Yeah, exactly. But we did talk about adapting it because we always do. And for example, when we talked about the PKD novel, Clans of the Alphane Moon, I wanted to radically change it for adaptation. I wanted to change who the main character was, switch things around, which, by the way, Larry extremely disagreed with me very wholeheartedly, and so it's a fun exchange because we had a very spirited discussion because I wanted to change the hell out of that book. But Waystation is one that I think has to be faithful, except for about adding the ticking clock of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the backdrop would really add some tension and would propel the story in a way that I think would be really cool. That being said, I think you could stay faithful to this story and really and keep it going. Cause I don't know. And you said you didn't have any problem reading that. You flew through this book too, right?
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
I did too. And for a book that doesn't have any kind of action or stuff like that, I think, and maybe this is, and I don't know how you feel about this, but for me, I really love, as I'm getting older, my favorite scenes are intense dialogue scenes.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and maybe that's, and we were just talking about the morning show, the Apple Plus TV show, which is very Aaron Sorkin. And if you had told me that I would like a show that was basically about the Today Show, right?
Right.
On paper, that doesn't make sense. But for me, like the dynamic of people butting heads and that personal dynamic can really propel a story. And I think that's what really propels Waystation. It's Enoch and Ulysses, and it's Enoch and whoever is visiting him.
Yeah.
You know, and it becomes this really interesting thing of just imagining. So like, you know, and I maybe should have done this in the non-spoiler, but for me, what I really dug about Waystation is I pictured this old man sitting on the porch with like maybe straw in his, you know, teeth, like sipping mint julep tea. And then he goes back inside and then, oh, here's, you know, a slime mold from Regulus 3. And they're going to talk about, you know, the speed of the quantum expansion of the universe or something. And
right.
Like, and I'm just pulling stuff out of my butt here, but this is the idea that is at the heart of this that is so neat, you know? And if he didn't, if any other author had written this, I think it wouldn't have that Midwestern feel. And I think Samak brings something you know, to it that I don't think Asimov could have written this book and have it work, right? Mm. And I don't think Heinlein could, and I know for sure that PKD couldn't write this book, because it's kind of funny to think about. But
yeah,
Samak is kind of alone on this. I mean, I could see maybe Le Guin or somebody like being able to sell this concept. But of the big names in science fiction at the time, it's very Samak, and I like it for that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of just one last thing about the potential adaptation. I feel like if the only way it could possibly work, if you updated it, you would kind of have to have like the government covering it up, like rather than them just discovering him. It would have had to been they discovered him years ago and they're keeping it quiet because people would freak out. But I don't like the way that would work.
I think if you had them. If you had like one agent who is just starting to figure it out, and then at the same time, this situation in Cuba is happening, like, you know, and he can't get anyone to listen to him because, like, hey, dude, the world's about to end, you know?
Right.
We don't have time for some farmhouse in Wisconsin, like, and your crazy theories, you know? Mm-hmm. That's how I would do that. But,
Well, we mentioned, we were talking about the day the Earth stood still, right? And in the updated version of it, the existential threat is no longer nuclear war, right? It's climate change.
And
it doesn't have quite the same impact, even though it absolutely is a threat. It's not as visceral to me as someone who grew up, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
The nuclear thing really does speak to me. Cause I remember, you and I must be similar age. I graduated in early 90s, high school.
Me too.
And, you know, I remember in school just thinking, yeah, okay, nuclear war, it will happen eventually. And so any fiction that delves into that threat really does speak to me.
Okay. So there's a fundamental difference for why the nuclear thing works in this regard. Climate change should be absolutely just as existential of a threat. In fact,
yes,
it's more likely to impact us than nuclear war. I mean, nuclear war, it was, if somebody had done it, then it's on, right?
Yeah.
So as an environmentalist, I really believe that climate change can and should be an existential threat. And I actually wrote, I have a novel specifically on this topic called Ring of Fire. And so not to shamelessly, I'm going to shamelessly plug my novel at this point.
Go for it.
Yeah. Ring of Fire is specifically about climate change and environmental factors as an existential threat. And to me, that is, you know, it's funny that you mentioned this because it shows a difference in our perspective, because there is nothing that is more frightening to me than that existential threat. That being said, I did grow up at the time, so I understand the threat of nuclear war, but I can tell you, I think I know through the lens of Waystation why it worked for you better, and why Day of the Earth still works better for you, is because climate change is something that is gradual, that happens slowly over time. Nuclear war would be an instantaneous choice that 0 to 60 in 15 minutes, the whole world could be gone. And it's a choice. It's very clear that Clifford Samak, in the context of Waystation and Robert Wise and so on, whoever made Day of the Earth Stood Still, when they're writing about this choice to do nuclear war, it's something that's much more tangible in the moment that you can look to for the maturity of the species. That gets back to, again, Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke. Science fiction was grappling with this choice. Star Trek did it several times. So science fiction was doing that, was exploring this single choice, whereas climate change is a series of choices that we're making as a species.
Yes.
That is, you know, it's the difference between setting your butt on fire and slowly and being in slowly boiling water, right?
Sure.
So I think in that regard, Waystation is a reflection of the times. And again, and I think what you were getting at, Seth, is that one of the reasons why you'd want to set it in period is so you could continue to explore that nuclear threat. But
yeah, definitely.
And it's fine. You know, so some people have said, well, the nuclear threat is not the threat that it once was. Those nuclear weapons are all still out there.
Yes, definitely.
They're still there. And we definitely saw a couple of years ago with the whole North Korea thing and, you know, with the kind of leadership that we have in the world between North Korea and the United States right now. And I mean, it's really scary to imagine who has control over those buttons. So yeah, let's still talk about those things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're not out of the woods yet.
Yeah.
Definitely not as a species in a number of ways.
Yeah.
All right. So let's pull back from the totally, terrifying ultimate fate of humanity for a bit.
I want to hear more of your opinion on WayStation for sure.
Yeah.
And you already said that I've sold you on reading more Samak. Like,
yes.
Yeah. What was your feeling? I mean, going into the first couple pages, how quickly did it hook you?
Oh, it hooked me quick. I mean, it started off with the agent talking about, I guess it started off with the Civil War. I mean, part of it was just being the captive audience, right? You're on a plane. I feel like
it's my favorite place to read too.
Yeah, it's like, what else am I going to do? I'm not going to watch movies or something. I can watch movies anytime. I like to read on planes, and just the way it kind of dropped you in there and gradually introduced you to the mystery of who this character was and his house being miraculously preserved and all of that. Just it pulled me in quick. I did like that I kind of pictured the teleportation thing as like the pneumatic tubes at a bank, where an alien comes squeezing out of it.
That's awesome. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, I was thinking more Stargate, but
And that makes sense. And you know, in an update, I definitely don't expect it to look like just a,
I would love that.
But yeah. See, I feel like there aren't enough movies made in like a retro future style. Or like the future as envisioned in the 50s.
Oh, Seth, we are on the same page. We are absolutely on the same page. I want so badly to make a retro sci-fi version of PKD's of Vulcan's Hammer. You have no idea.
Nice. you know, when you talk to physicists or scientists about teleportation, right? A lot of them will say, well, if you get teleported, you die in the original place and then, you know, are transported instantaneously to the other in a brand new body. And is that still you? Is it a copy of you? And this book takes a position on that
it's a cop.
It's like in the novel, The Prestige, mm-hmm. Where you have a teleportation that happens and it leaves behind an empty shell and creates a new one on the other end.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you can go back into your shell when you transport back as part of the idea here, right? Or am I?
I thought they disposed of the copy on the other
end. Yeah, and so you just keep getting a new. Well, that could be really good health-wise if you get a little healthier version of yourself.
Right. Yeah. Like old man's war.
Yeah, exactly. Like you could, that could potentially expand your life. And
yeah.
Well, and here's the interesting thing with the physics of it, and it is that if you, considering relative time dilation, and if you transport 25 light years away instantaneously, you're traveling time as well, because you're not at the same, you know, if you, and I'll just use Vega as an example, because we had Vegan travelers. That is 25 light years from Earth. So if you instantly walk through to Enoch's place and you walked outside into Wisconsin and looked up at Vega in the sky, that what you're seeing is 25 years later, right?
Right.
So at all times in the universe, the past, present, and future are coexisting at different distances. So, so I guess with that, you would be... That gets into issues of whether I'm sorry, I'm nerding out on the physics of it, but
no, I like it.
but the idea of it, what I liked about it is that if you're transporting a duplicate of yourself, then it doesn't matter what time you came from, because you now exist as that duplicate in this in this other part of space and time.
Yeah. No, I think he had it backwards there, where you would, if you walked out of Vega onto Earth, you'd be if you looked up in the sky, you'd be seeing Vega from the past. It's like you went 25 years into the future. Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. So, So, and those are neat things about that's going on in this book with the ideas is it could be, you could really easily look at this book as like, I could see some of the millennial readers, and I'm using Anthony as an example because anyone who's listened to our podcast and use like a lot of these ideas, he'll be like, so what, you know? And I'm sure if I pitched this idea to Anthony, he'd be like, it's in a farmhouse, you know, it all takes place in a farmhouse. So exciting. But I think you have to look at these crazy ideas of physics that are involved in this story. It's so much more than just hanging out in a farmhouse. Like, there are these like really cool concepts of physics and things that are going on, you know, they're right there. And it might not be some Mac's most exciting idea, but man, the execution is really good. And I will tell you that the more I've talked about this book, the more I appreciated it. But talking about it and exploring the themes have made me appreciate it even more.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, he sprinkles in some kind of big ideas as well, because there's the whole thing where he used some kind of alien technology to summon avatars out of his head to keep him company, you know, mm-hmm. and there's that tragic moment where like he forgets that they're not real and reaches out to touch one of them. And it almost made me cry, just like the mistake that he made there and the way he couldn't walk it back.
Yeah. Great moment. And you read this more recently than I did. I read it like 2 months ago. So, so you're probably going to remember more of those moments.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you, moments that really stuck out? That was a great moment. The one that you just referenced.
I mean, it's not so much a moment as, I dug the notion of the spiritual force and the talisman that they use to actually communicate with the spiritual force. Cause as a person who is, I'm a Christian, I know you're Jewish.
Not practicing, just culturally. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. But, at least there's some culture there.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where like, I'm fine with an author who's an atheist, like deciding that is what the reality is for his fiction. But I like when, you know, an author will be like, oh, well, what if it was this, you know, where religions that spawn up on planets are all kind of shadows of this underlying reality. And I don't know, it was interesting to me. I thought that the twist that Lucy was the new guardian was like the most obvious twist ever. Mm-hmm. But I don't really fault it for that. I still just like that there was some.
Well,
some
that's another connection to the whole Steinbeck thing too, if you think about it, because you know she's disabled and you know picked on by like the people in the town. So I hadn't thought about that earlier, but yeah, that's part of the of Mice and Men comparison.
Yeah, that's a good point.
No, I like the spiritual aspect of it too. Well, I don't have a particular religion that I adhere to. I consider myself a spiritual person to a degree. I think what Samak is kind of hinting at here unintentionally is something similar to the beliefs of the Baha'i faith is probably the closest.
Mm.
And PKD did a ridiculous version of the Baha'i faith under duress from his editor in Eye in the Sky, but don't judge that religion from that book. He had meant to have a very Christian aspect to the story, but Don Wolheim, his editor, was like, no, don't touch Christianity. And so he changed it to the Baha'i faith for no logical reason. Mm-hmm. And it's the one thing that keeps that book from being an absolute banger masterpiece. But I just kind of rewrite it in my, you know how like you update the Klingons look in your head when you watch the original series?
Right.
When I read Eye in the Sky, I just redid it as Christianity in my head because that's the way he wrote it and it makes the most sense. What Samak is talking about here in religion wise is this idea that there's all one essential truth and the religions in these different worlds are kind of teaching this. That's kind of what the Baha'is believe on this planet is that all the religions of the world are just variations on that one same truth, right?
Yeah.
And I think Samak was trying to get to that idea partially because I'm not sure what his religion was, but I believe he was a religious person. So, you know, I don't think it, yeah, I don't think you're off on that. I think that that was definitely a theme that he was going for there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I appreciated that part of it too. And I hadn't thought about the Lucy thing. It was not a shocker in the story, but it's okay. It's delivered the way it's supposed to be in the story and it works.
Yeah. And it's still a good moment.
Yeah.
And it's followed by kind of the one action set piece in the book where that weird rat alien comes through with the talisman and
yeah, he was pretty cool.
He was
pretty cool. Yeah, and Samak can do that stuff. I mean, he does. If you want to see Samak write a story that's more action based, he has a time travel novel called Time and Again that is kind of PKD ish. Too, but that one has like time travelers and chases and things like that.
Nice.
So I mean, he can do that if he wanted to.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I liked was Enoch's friendship with Winslow, the mailman. There's some good moments between them, and it's like Winslow is just like, okay, this guy's something, but I don't really care. You know, I just know he's my friend, right?
Right.
And I like that. At some point, Enoch is talking to him and he says, you know, I wish I could tell you, you know, what's going on, what I am. And Winslow says to him, and I wrote this down, well, it don't matter much what any of us are, just so we get along with one another. If some of the nations would only take a lesson from some small neighborhood like ours, a lesson in how to get along, the world would be a whole lot better. And, you know, that's the kind of sentiment anybody can get behind.
Yeah. Yeah. Good call. That is a great scene. And it recalls to me, like, for example, like Joe R. Lansdale has his Happen Leonard series is about, you know, it takes place in East Texas, which you generally think is redneck country.
I went to college in East Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and those books are about a ex-hippie and a gay black man in East Texas who are best friends solve mysteries. And so, and Joe R. Lansdale talks about I've seen him introduce the books at book events, and he always talks about redneck tolerance and how it's, there's an underrated redneck tolerance. And, that scene that you mentioned reminded me of that. And I think that that relationship is one of the coolest relationships of the book. Mm-hmm. For sure.
I thought it was cool that, you know, like aliens would bring him like samples of wood and then he'd give them to Winslow, and Winslow was into carving things. And, you know, he didn't know where all that wood came from.
But. Yeah. Well, and just think about that. Yeah. Like a piece of wood from like the other side of the galaxy. And he had no idea. Yeah. Really neat stuff.
What did you think of at some point there's the, the trouble with the body disappears. And so Enoch is kind of in trouble for that. And I think maybe he's talking to Ulysses and saying, you know, what can we do to prevent the impending war that I see coming here? Cause he's used some kind of alien spreadsheet to put all the data in that he knows about what's going on Earth. And he sees that it inexorably leads to war. Basically he gets presented with the option to make everybody on Earth stupid for a few generations so that they can't make war.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting part of the book because he's basically saying, you know, that comes down to can we never get the maturity as a species, and would we'd be better off? And I got to tell you, my answer would have been I think I would make humanity stupid. if I was given that ability, I would take us backwards if I could, just because we're not being responsible with the planet as we are. I mean, like, honestly, we are not. If you look at the way we're treating the planet, we're not being responsible with it. And, so it's funny because when I read that part of the book, I was like, do it, you know? from my perspective, So I'm kind of a weird person to talk to you about that aspect of the book, but I thought it was, I understood where he, I can understand why somebody would not make that decision and say like, well, we've got to be better and still move forward. But it's just funny because just from my perspective, that's exactly where my brain went. But it was, that part does such a good job of expressing the theme of maturity by giving somebody the ability, like we were saying about, it's kind of like the opposite of having the ability to press the big red button and launch all the nukes.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, and I've talked about this before on the podcast, but as a writer, my belief in storytelling comes down to, and I got this, I stole this from the screenwriter Shane Black. Shane Black, who wrote Iron Man 3, Long Kiss Goodnight, the most recent Predator movie, the Lethal Weapon movies. Mm-hmm. Anyways, Shane Black always says that the essence of storytelling is parallels and reversals, right?
Mm.
And what's great about WayStation and what you hit on is the parallels and reversals here are... he does parallels and reversals right in that. So the human race can destroy itself by pushing the button, and Enoch has the ability to push the button back and make that choice. And there isn't clear, I don't know how much there are clear answers as to what's the right thing, wrong thing, whatever, as much as the exploration of these themes are so brilliant in this book. And you know, I give this book some grief in saying that I think Cat's Cradle should have won the Hugo that year.
Sure.
However, it is a damn good book. It is worthy of winning the Hugo. I would say over all the other nominees, even though we have strong nominees, we have Heinlein, we have Andre Norton, we have Dune, the original version of Dune, the first novella. I don't know how it stands on its own as a novella, because I've only ever read it as the whole novel, but
right.
However, it is a worthy Hugo winner. Unlike, for example, the book that won the next year, The Wanderer, which is just hot, steaming garbage, and completely inexplicable how it won.
Hmm.
You know, spoiler alert for my episode about The Wanderer by Fritz Lieber.
I haven't gotten there yet, so.
Oh, Seth. I hate to color it for you.
I'm in for a treat.
It's totally bad, but it's hilarious, though. I don't, you know, it's like you can watch a hilariously bad movie because it's like 2 hours of your life, but it's much harder to read a hilariously bad book. But yeah, the anarchist sex cats in it are, get ready for those.
I'm not sure you can ever be ready for that.
You cannot be ready for the anarchist sex cats, but they're coming. So,
wow.
Yay 60s.
Yeah.
But I mean, and that was definitely Fritz Lieber, the old guy, saying, I can run with these young weird whippersnappers was The Wanderer.
Yeah.
But I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm talking about a different book. WayStation definitely deserves to win the Hugo Award. I don't know that it's better than Cat's Cradle, honestly, but I understand it's also a lifetime achievement award.
Sure. Well, maybe we should kind of segue that into kind of final thoughts. I totally agree. I thought it was a really fun read. Surprisingly deep for as short as it is. And it's definitely one that'll reward, I think, a reread. So it may be one of those ones where I'm like, I find the audiobook for it at some point just to take it in again in a different medium.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be interested to see what happens with the proposed adaptation.
I really hope it happens. I mean, a lot of these projects get announced and never happen, but, you know, if the Batman does well with Matt Reeves, then we probably are more likely to see it. But, WayStation is great. It is fun read. My final thoughts, I would like to put it in the context of the entire 60s, and it's a strange one compared to some of the other winners of the 60s, because the 60s have a lot of powerhouse science fiction novels, from starting with Starship Troopers in 1960 and ending in 1969 with Stand on Zanzibar. And Stand on Zanzibar is by far one of my favorite science fiction novels of all time. And
I think that was the first one you put in the contact form that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, and we've already released our episode on that. So that's one of the ones we've already released. Stand on Zanzibar, to me, is one of the greatest ultimate masterpieces of 60s science fiction, or science fiction in general. And yeah. I can't really put Waystation to the level with that one. And then when you look at some of the other winners, like Stranger in a Strange Land, Moon is a Harsh Mistress, you have some pretty, pretty well-known classics. But I would tell you, and spoiler alert for our episode in Stranger in a Strange Land, I think Waystation is far superior to Stranger in a Strange Land in retrospect. Heinlein has not aged well for me.
Yeah.
Recently, but Samak, I think, and this is why I wanted to put in the context, I think it ages really well. I think it holds up. There's maybe a few cringy things, but for the most part, I think this is a really rock solid piece of historical science fiction should be read. So, but yeah, I think, you know, Samak in general, everybody's got to read City. That's the one.
Sounds good. I'll pick that up next time I see it come around on the $1.99.
Yeah, and I don't know if 1953 has been awarded a retro Hugo yet, but it did win the World Fantasy Award in 1953. And so I don't know if they've done 53 for retro Hugo.
No, they won't do it for retro, because that's actually the first year for Hugo's. That was The Demolished Man.
Oh yeah. Oh, tough competition. Yeah. Which I have not, I have not read yet, because I've been saving, because Barry Maltzberg, another classic science fiction, when we interviewed him on our podcast, Barry Maltzberg said The Demolished Man was his favorite science fiction novel of all time.
Oh, nice.
You know, which is high praise coming from the guy who wrote Beyond Apollo and Galaxies. Yeah. But yeah, if people haven't read Barry Maltzberg, they ought to do that too.
Right. Well, we should probably head towards signing off. So how can people find you or your podcast?
All right. So I'm on Twitter at D Agranoff author. That's D A G R A N O F F author. On the Twitters. We are also at Dickheads Pod on Twitter for the podcast. The problem was that Apple Podcasts thought we were a penis podcast. So unfortunately, we are not on as many podcast platforms as we would like to be. However, you can follow us on SoundCloud and YouTube. We are active on both. The episodes show up much slower to YouTube because the video editing is much more complicated. But all the episodes are up on SoundCloud, and I promise you, if you have to download the SoundCloud app just for us, we try to make the content worth it.
Right.
And you can look me up on Facebook, and I also have a fan page on Facebook for my writing and all that jazz, but definitely Twitter is the easiest and for me. And please check out my science fiction novel, Goddamn Killing Machines. It is like gonzo action sci-fi with a PKD twist. And it's new. This is my first solo science fiction novel. A couple of years ago, I wrote a science fiction novel called Flesh Trade with Edward Morris. And that is also that's a mind-bendy sci-fi action thing too. But it's a little harder to find, but it is out there. You can find all my work on Amazon. And please check out the books. I'd love to hear from some new readers. That'd be awesome.
Nice.
And I love your podcast, so I'm super excited to be here. And I'm coming back.
Thanks, man.
For The Dispossessed, which I can't wait because I love that book.
Yeah, we can do that one down the line.
All right. Thanks for having me, Seth.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I definitely want to encourage people to check out your podcast as well. And, you know, I'm just subscribed on my phone. I didn't have to download SoundCloud. You can still get an RSS feed from it. So,
yeah. And for one of the reasons I'm super excited to do The Dispossessed is because that is not in the 60s. So that will be, right. And it's one of my all-time favorite novels by Le Guin.
Nice. Cool. All right. Well, it was great talking to you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Talk again. All right. Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with David, and I definitely encourage you to check out, if you're a fan of Philip K. Dick, you'll want to check out the PK Dickheads. They do a great job. It's a lot of fun discussions with three people, at least three people. Of course, I want to remind you, if you want to support any of my podcasts, and you can go up to patreon.com/hugospodcast and support for as little as a dollar a month, and I would appreciate that. Help me pay hosting fees and maybe upgrade equipment at some point. And of course, if you want to do something non-monetary to support the show, tell your friends about it. Leave us a rating or a review wherever you listen to us. That'd be fantastic. I think that's going to do it, though. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.